Good evening, good afternoon. How is everybody doing? Hopefully everybody's doing well, whenever, however you're listening to this. Today's show is going to be all about the war in Ukraine and what's kind of happened over the last couple weeks. It feels like forever since I recorded a podcast because the one I released last week with Jason Smith, I recorded on the 12th of February. And obviously I put that out last week because we did the show with Lynch Mob, which you can watch if you become a channel member for $2.99 a month. I figured out this little GoPro thing right here actually records really, really good video, audio, and everything. And if you don't want to pay for that, then you can see our performance of The Reckoning, which I put up on the channel for free. But once again, if you want to see the full performance and then tomorrow's performance as well, which will probably be uploaded Friday or Saturday, $2.99 a month. Anyways, yeah, the war in Ukraine, the whole meeting with Zelensky, Vance, and Trump, I've had a lot of thoughts on that. I'm sure my guest does today as well, and I figured he'd be a great person to have on to talk about this. And it's been a little bit, I think about 32 episodes since he's been on. So yeah, episode 358 was the last show that we did, and I think it was on the Kamala Harris ad, which is hysterical, so you guys should go check that out. But anyways, before we get rock and roll in today's show, make sure you hit all the links below to figure out where you can find my guest, everything he's got going on. Tiger Fitness through the link below. Use the code Kyle at checkout to let him know I sent you. You just missed their Arnold sale if you're going to purchase them, purchase stuff off them right now. But obviously, they're going to be having a Memorial Day sale in a couple of weeks. I'm sure they'll have an Easter sale and then some other sales, you know, in between now and, you know, whenever you decide to buy. So if not, my code Kyle will get you 10% off and let them know that I sent you. So without further ado, let's get into today's conversation. Is the war in Ukraine done?
Engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
And returning to the show today, Brad Pierce, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me back on.
Yeah, of course. Well, like I said in the introduction, the last time you were on was during the election season. I believe it was only a week or two beforehand because it was all about the Man Enough ad, but whatever the hell it was with all those weirdos in Kamala Harris's ad. So, you know, kind of looking back at then till now, it's like we live in a completely different world.
Oh, yeah. It's really, in many ways, hard to believe that Joe Biden was ever president. It's just, it's so strange. You know, like I've been calling it the Biden Regency since it ended because we kind of forgot what it's like to have an actual president, regardless of what you think of what Trump's doing. It was just crazy the extent to which Biden was so obviously stage managed all the time and was not a very, you know, active figure in American public life, despite being the president.
Yeah, I remember Scott Horton saying this, that it has to be like Jake Sullivan pretty much running the show. And that's pretty much what it was. Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken, Lloyd Austin kind of doing whatever they wanted. And then Kamala Harris kind of cackling and then Joe Biden running off into the woods. But obviously, there's a lot of nefarious stuff going on underneath the surface there.
Yeah.
So one thing before we started kind of getting into Ukraine, I wanted to talk about the congressional address. So I know you said you didn't watch, but what did you think of the highlights that you just heard of? I literally watched the whole thing right before we hopped on here today.
Well, I mean, the main thing that is notable to me is how useless the Democrats are being, you know, at being an opposition party. Like, as Daniel McCarthy was saying, that, you know, they're trying to use the tactics of college protesters, but, you know, they look like they're you know, like an old folks home trip to a casino or something. So, I mean, what's really iconic is that guy shaking his cane at Trump. Like, that's like the perfect image of the modern Democrat Party. It's just like an angry old man shaking his cane at someone. So, I mean, and, you know, it was rated really highly. They, you know, wouldn't even clap at like the kid that survived cancer or, you know, show respect for like a young woman that was murdered, you know, et cetera. It's absolutely outrageous. But, you know, I mean, and Trump was right that, you know, nothing that he could possibly do would ever please them. So, you know, there's no point in even worrying about it. Though, I mean, you know, last time when he was president, when, you know, he bombed Syria, like the Syrian government or whatever, they were like, oh, he's finally being presidential. That's like the first time I've ever felt like he was an American or whatever. So, you know, he'll probably find something awful to do that they will all universally agree on. But, you know, anything he does that any normal person would think is positive, they're not going to give him credit for anything. And it's good he knows that. He wasted a bunch of his first term thinking he could find some sort of understanding with these people, you know, from the beginning with the whole Russiagate thing, et cetera, thinking he could manage them, get them to work for him, that he could use, you know, people that had been in Washington and knew everyone. And at every turn, they just showed that, you know, they believe that they are the state, that they should be self-running this, that, you know, the important things about our government should be kept out of democratic control, et cetera. And so, you know, he may still be a complete Israel cuck, but besides that, I mean, there is like the third rail in American politics that he's still not touching. But besides that, he definitely seems to have properly learned, you know, that he can't work with these people. And, you know, I think to an extent, last time he was kind of the dog that caught the car, you know, that he like knew he wanted to be president, but hadn't properly put thought into what he would do. Whereas, you know, I mean, he had kind of been saying like off the cuff, like, oh, I would make a great president, you know, he'd been saying this since like the 80s or whatever. But, you know, most people that become president, they've been in politics for a long time. You know, Joe Biden had wanted to be president since like 1988 or whatever. Like, I mean, that's excessively long. But in general, they've thought about it a lot. They know how politics work, et cetera. And so, you know, Trump clearly had a lot more time to think about this time, and also to, yeah, realize that there's no pleasing these people and that the only thing to do is to destroy them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of surprising because if you would have listened to his campaign, you would have thought that he generally would have kind of rolled over like he did a lot in his first term. But I'm genuinely surprised because it for the most part, even in his first term, it really didn't seem like he learned anything at all. But this time around, it seems different so far. Obviously, we're still pretty early in, so it's really hard to say how much stamina is he going to have. And I think that's the one thing that nobody's really asking is, like, how long is he going to put up a fight? And is he going to have to? Where, you know, like, I think the first thing that we're kind of seeing now is basically, like, they're striking down his, you know, abolition of USAID. And basically, they're saying they have to go forth with putting those funds out there.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really a strange thing. Like, you know, the first time they like struck down him getting rid of the Dreamer, you know, Obama's dream thing for the illegal immigrant children or whatever. And, you know, that was like put into place by executive order. So where the hell does a judge get off saying that it can't be removed the same way? Like, that's nonsense. You know, the thing about this flare of things is that then it is going to keep his opponents occupied for years as this very stuff plays out. You know, some of this stuff, like, we, you know, like the stuff they say about birthright citizenship is totally counter to, you know, the original intention of the program and, you know, everything else like that. Not a lot of people realize that. And, you know, they took the most maximalist view of the court rulings that there were and other things of that nature. But it was obviously the case when they put that into effect that everyone knew that they were going to, you know, that he's getting it to the court again. There's a very different Supreme Court than there was the last time it was ruled on. You know, which they've been a mixed bag, but regardless, it's not like it was some sort of setback for him that he did the birthright citizenship thing and then it got struck down by a judge. Like, it was obviously the intention, the known thing that he was creating a new Supreme Court challenge to hopefully create a new Supreme Court precedent. And that's how a lot of these things are. But, you know, the judiciary is completely out of control. This practice of a regional judge being able to make nationwide rulings is ridiculous. Everyone openly shops around. You know, Congress has the power to just get rid of plenty of these district courts. They don't even have to exist, technically. Mm-hmm. You know, so we'll see. But yeah, it's absolutely the case that, you know, these lawyers think they're philosopher kings over our country. This is how the Democrats like it because it's, you know, it's been primarily their faction. Judges are usually by their nature highly institutional. You know, you're highly pro-institution in general by the time you become a judge. So we'll see how it all goes. But there's pretty widespread support for a lot of this. And, you know, of course, everything the Democrats do is counterproductive. Like, they just keep making their loathing for the public clear. You know, they they laughed at people that were losing their jobs over the vaccine, or that were complaining when, you know, they were shut down and couldn't go to work, et cetera. Since COVID ended, we've been hearing all this shit about a labor shortage. They say we need all these H-1B workers, et cetera, et cetera. And then they're acting like federal workers can't find another job. It's like, okay, look, I'm sorry if you're really that useless, but like in theory, you have a college degree and, you know, 15 years experience or something. Like, you should be able to get a job if you are willing to do anything. They're acting like it's not the case that any office has, you know, completely useless paper pushers that work like an hour a day. You know, someone said it's like Stanley on the show, The Office, you know, that's what these people are like. And they're all just standing up for it and acting like there's not a bunch of time wasted, et cetera. It's absurd. And, you know, all of the polling shows that, well, not all of the polling, but the majority of quality polling shows that Trump is popular with more people than, you know, those that voted for him. Yet the Democrats just keep constantly saying, do you regret your vote yet? And, you know, making up these people that voted for Trump but are now really disappointed. But it's like, okay, well, why do none of us ever talk to them? Like these supposed people that, you know, voted for him and are now like disgusted by what he's doing. You're obviously just making shit up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's probably like a small contingent of people who probably got some shit that they sincerely didn't want. To me, and I'm a broken record with this stuff, but I think, you know, the appointment of Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz, although, you know, shockingly, Rubio said some good things. Obviously, I'm waiting for this other shoe to drop. And then all the, you know, you said it before I did, but being an Israel cuck and specifically making the most egregious First Amendment violations based around Israel and how nobody's talking about that just blows my mind on a daily basis.
Yeah, so I mean, that I am angry about, and I am talking about it, obviously. Yeah. But once again, the other thing is like, I don't know. I think the Democrats are also just so used to completely falling into line once you elect someone. Like, they don't have even a degree of strategic thinking to be like, oh, well, you know, 90%, 90, 95% of stuff he's doing is way better than it would have been with the opponent. So, yeah, but there are these some bad things he's doing that I'm, you know, openly criticizing. But we also knew what we were doing or what we were getting into. And I mean, the Democrats are going to be just as ridiculous on Israel, or close to as ridiculous on Israel. They're just going to phrase it in a different, less honest way. So, you know.
So I think to your point, though, and I wanted to make sure I got this part in too, is that basically like all these government workers that are getting fired, I kind of look at this like the homeless situation where people are like, oh my God, well, where are they going to go? Who cares?
Yeah, that's not my problem. What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. These people have been getting a six-figure salary for probably decades at this point, doing absolutely nothing other than driving up our debt, driving up wages, or actually probably driving down, you know, private sector wages because they're taking so much capital out of the private sector that, like, I don't care if you get fired. Like, Elon and Trump are even being more generous than personally I think they should be, where they're giving them severance packages and, you know, like, hey, you get a year or two of your salary. No, fuck you. You're done. Bye.
Well, and it's crazy too, because like they'll say anything. Like, they're trying to claim, you know, with the whole email thing, that it's not possible to contact these people to tell them to respond to an email. They're like, oh, they've been, you know, these people, they're not on Twitter, not everyone hears about this. It's like, okay, well, it's a top story on Google News, and everyone else they know are government employees. But they're like, oh, they have no way to, they're basically saying that there's no way to contact these people to tell them to check their email, and that they're locked out because they haven't checked it in 60 days. And it's like, they sound really essential. The operation, then, like, this is the point. What are you talking about?
You're a government worker who your job is probably to communicate with people, right? And somehow you haven't checked your email.
Well, you know, and they keep being like, oh, you've obviously only had email jobs, and that's fine, but, you know, this isn't the reality of most workers. Okay, like, you work in an auto shop. How long does it take them to get a memo to you on a Monday morning if you need to do something that week?
I mean, it's usually like, if it's something from GM or from the managers, normally our manager will come back, hey, you know, we're going to have a shop meeting here, if it's that important. In a situation like this, where it's the potential layoff of people, you'd think your boss would be like, hey, you're going to get an email. And like, a friend of mine, Trey, who I would say is probably definitely more like dissident right-leaning, he's like, well, this is kind of bullshit because like the people who are actually doing work don't want to be bothered with this kind of stuff. But once again, at the same time, I do think those are necessary casualties to get rid of all
their government employees. Jobs. How often were they bothered with nonsense before? All the damn time. Like,
that's our entire job.
At any job, they have the ability to talk to you on a Monday morning about what you need to do and tell you have to spend 10 minutes doing some idiot requirement. Like, the one I think is, so I have a friend who's a university janitor. He hates his job. He says everyone who works with are a bunch of idiots. He has terrible morale, and I think more or less does as little as possible, right? this dude could check his email on a Monday morning and email you this by noon. No problem. No,
right.
You know, like he might talk shit about it on the internet afterwards or whatever, which is fine. You just have to do it. And yeah, so the other thing I keep thinking, so like imagine these people, like if they actually leave their job because they were unwilling to fill out a 10-minute email, imagine how much their kids are going to hate them in like 30 years. They're like living in their basement because they lost their pension and they don't have any money because they like left their government job because they wouldn't send a goddamn email to Elon Musk because they were radicalized by MSNBC. And so now they're like impoverished and living off their children in their retirement. It's absolutely absurd.
Yeah. Well, one other thing is the whole like, oh, Elon Musk is an unelected bureaucrat and he has your social security number. Like, first of all, what is the richest man in the world going to do with your social security number? And second of all, I don't give a fuck if he was, you know, the most dirt poor or even twice as rich as he is now. If he's getting rid of government jobs and he's cleaning up, you know, the absolute disaster that got us $36 trillion in debt. And granted, like, I think what he's doing now is probably generally a drop in the bucket compared to like, you know, entitlements and military. It's still a step in the right direction. I don't care. I'm not offended by that. And it's not like there weren't fucking billionaire Democrats that were doing shady shit, you know, getting NGO money. And that's largely what it is that like a lot of these NGOs that Trump and USAID has basically been, you know, cut out now. These were largely funded by the government and they should have never been funded or existed in the first place. These jobs at the IRS should have never existed in the first place. There's so many things that are being done that are getting rid of people that just should have never had that opportunity in the first place.
Well, yeah, you know, Harry Hopkins, who was FDR's main New Deal guy that was put in charge of like, the Civil Works Administration, that was created by executive order and he never had to be confirmed by the Senate or anything. So like there are specific well-known individuals that have been put in government positions way, way more powerful than Elon Musk to, you know, do whatever to transform the country that did not go through any sort of Senate confirmation, you know, et cetera. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, the other thing is with the personalities of both Trump and Musk, you know, they're falling out sooner rather than later. Elon's going to have to go back to running his actual businesses that he has and all this other shit. He's just getting them off to a start. But, you know, the Democrats are just letting themselves be ran around. They've made themselves the party that's in favor of waste, fraud and abuse. Like, you know, it was one of them. I think it was Robert Reich was saying something like, OK, so like, imagine that there is waste, fraud and abuse in government or something. That's like, imagine. This is your theoretical example of saying this exists, you know, and it's a valid criticism that people are like, oh, you know, the Government Accountability Office, you know, already exists. It's known for being really professional. You know, they put out these reports and Congress never listens to them or whatever. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that being the case, Democrats, then tell Republicans you want to start implementing their recommendations and try to get them to work with you on that. That's a reasonable criticism of this. So, and that's a real thing you can do. This office already exists. They have 20 years of reports piled up that Congress refused to implement, probably. Just do that then, if that make that your alternative to this, because you let this bloat go on forever. But it's, you know, it's their entire social class lives off of this shit, the entire NGO scam, et cetera. You know, all of their class and Ukrainians. This is our link to Ukraine here, is that it's like they have like a USAID government completely, you know, that's a ruling faction. It's like USAID with Nazi characteristics is who's in charge of Ukraine.
That's a good point. And one thing that could probably wrap us up on the whole, you know, Trump and Doge and stuff like that, is that I think the Democrats are so rudderless because there's no clear heir to the throne. Like people keep saying Gavin Newsom or Josh Shapiro, but like, it's not really clear that these guys are like the guy next, right? No. Like there's nobody that really stands out as the next Democratic leader, especially after all the California wildfires. I find it hard for him to have like a rehabilitation and, you know, maybe Josh Shapiro, but I mean, even he still doesn't have like the name recognition amongst your average Democrats. And then, you know, maybe this whole, you know, I know they're all into the war in Ukraine, but like, I don't know, signing bombs, just something about that, I think for the average person doesn't look good.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's totally out of control. I don't know what's wrong with them. I mean, I've written plenty about what's wrong with them. Actually, I have a fairly good idea. You just can't say it, you know, explain it that quickly. But regardless, it's not unusual that they would be in the wilderness after a loss like this. It's kind of like stick to fundamentals. The other funny thing is they keep like arguing about, you know, oh, should they move to the center? And it's like, well, what does that mean? Like, the issue is that you need to ditch the zany social issues that have like 20% support, like, you know, men and women sports and stuff like that, and become less obsessed with asinine regulations. And they need to move just purely strategically, it doesn't matter what would be good policy or whatever, they need to move to the center on social issues while focusing on civil rights for everyone, you know, like everyone being treated equally under the law, basically, and then move to the left on economic issues that are actually designed to help the public. Because the thing is, you know, the regulations they're obsessed with creates a huge class of these same people that are getting fired now, which is a big part of their base. So it's like a make work program for Democrats at the expense of everyone else. But the thing about Scandinavia is that it's more or less true that businesses can handle a high level of taxation if you're not wasting all of their time on bullshit compliance costs. This is like actually well established whether or not you should. So, you know, they could take an easy policy like, look, we support rights for everyone, but we've been too focused on these zany social issues that don't help anyone. We have, in fact, overregulated. It's stopping the productivity that we need to fund a welfare state. But then, you know, we're looking at these ways to increase the amount of taxes that are collected so we can get the budget under control and put new social programs in place that are designed to help the working man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a straightforward whether I don't know if anyone could have won against Trump, but it's like the fundamentals that they can get back to and have something to say to the public. But instead, they're just a bunch of like geriatrics who think that they're in the civil rights era. It's absolutely pathetic.
Yeah, really. I mean, I think there is the real opportunity for someone on the left to basically run to what people would colloquially call like the left on foreign policy, where basically they go completely non-interventionist, like make Trump look like an interventionist because he still is. But like, you know, they could say, hey, they stood up to Israel. If they stood up to, you know, the military industrial complex, like a Kennedy, you know, could have, not RFK, because, you know, obviously he's a lunatic on Israel. But like, you know, if someone sincerely came out as the anti-interventionist left, and like you said, kind of forced more of these like socialist family worker class focused issues. Not that I would agree with them, but I mean, there's a real chance to really win support. But I just don't see that happening unless like over the next 4 years, somehow this spurs this whole rebirth of the Democrat Party. And I don't see it. I do
well,
not
yeah,
see that happening.
Something like we're going to deregulate building housing and release a, I don't know, tax voucher or whatever for, you know, new home building. This is going to stimulate the economy by creating all these construction jobs. And, you know, it's going to save Americans money by getting them, you know, dealing with their shortage on housing. You know, the other thing is, though, their third rail on this is immigration, though, because anyone that actually wants economic left policies and to have a functioning welfare state and to have affordable housing and to have good wages for American workers, you have to stop the mass immigration, which they have an activist base. It's not even their activist base that is at fault, actually. It's just easy to say that. They have their oligarch, their oligarch center does not want to do this because they want cheap foreign workers and they completely control the party. So they can't really go with that either. So, I mean, I don't know. They're still twisted up into a pretzel. Like there's definitely a desire within the country for a party that is more anti-war, is more straightforward on civil liberties, and is the economic left is more anti-corporate more than anything, you know, because they're just their woke capital is the center of their party, is, you know, Citibank funding a pride parade is the heart of the Democrats.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's exactly what it is, honestly. So now would probably be a good time for us to move on to Ukraine finally, which is what today's show is about. Let's start out at kind of what Trump was campaigning on when it came to Ukraine. So I know what I think about his campaign, you know, obviously over the 2024, late 2023 election cycle. But when he was campaigning, what were your thoughts about some of the stuff that he was saying?
Well, you know, in April, when there was what I called the Trump-Biden World War III bill, which I think you had him in a show about that, too.
Yeah, we did a show about that.
You know, he got together with Johnson. He got them to pass this huge aid package to Ukraine. You know, he was the one that originally gave them Stingers and all this other stuff like that in his first term, when Obama had only been giving them non-lethal supplies, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, he kept seeming increasingly bad about it. But I mean, at the same time, it's like impossible to be worse on Ukraine than the Democrats are, because their policies just go, we'll roll over to them over and over again. You know, we'll let the escalation ladder go up, but we won't do anything that could end the conflict or could bring about peace. And, you know, the Rachel Maddows, et cetera, have spent way too long making it impossible for their party to do anything with Russia. So, I mean, we knew that Trump would hopefully be at least marginally better, though in April I wasn't feeling that way. But, you know, he didn't say that much about it on the trail. You know, he had this whole ended in 24 hours thing or whatever, which was obviously nonsense. But at the same time, like, you know, it was Ukraine that got him impeached the first time. It was two Ukrainian-American brothers in our government who, you know, recorded or took the recording and who released the recording. So, you know, it was them corrupting our own state. And it was to protect Hunter Biden's corruption. That was obviously real. You know, Biden himself admitted to getting the prosecutor fired publicly, just as an amusing anecdote. And, you know, so all of that, but really, they also just made a huge mistake because, like, it's a shit lib government there. It is part of the, you know, the global USAID class, et cetera. And so all of their supporters are that way too. And they just got really, partisan on American politics. All of their supporters were, and it's like a whole nation of Democrats, as I've been saying for years now. And so that was, of course, going to come back to bite them. They bet on the wrong horse. Like Zelensky went around with Shapiro to the armaments factory during an election, you know, et cetera. They just stupid mistake on their part. But, you know, they're not Machiavellians. They're idiots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed completely. So the other thing I kind of wanted to throw in there, while we're kind of talking about Trump's campaign, was when somebody asked him, and I wish I could find this interview, but they asked him what he would do to end the war in Ukraine. And his explicit answer was, I'll tell Russia I'm going to give Ukraine more than they've ever gotten. And I'll tell Ukraine, you don't know what we'll do. Basically, the one China policy, right? Where basically it's strategic ambiguity, where China don't mess around because you don't know what we'll do. Taiwan, don't go brave because you don't know what we'll do. That was kind of the position that he was basically stating for Ukraine.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically what he stated was that if Russia is not willing to make a deal, I'm going to arm Ukraine like I've never done before. And if Ukraine's not willing to make a deal, I'm going to cut off all of their arms, which is basically what has happened now is Ukraine didn't understand that. I don't know how Zelensky could have, you know, he was there to kiss the ring. Like that's what he was supposed to be doing. He had to just behave himself, but he's so used to, you know, dealing with people that are inexplicably reverent of him, despite that he's basically like a little goblin. So
yeah, he thought he was going to get treated like Netanyahu, but instead he basically got treated like Gaddafi.
Yeah, right. Something like that.
Yeah. So, God.
I don't know who was advising him, who made him think that this was appropriate, you know. And allegedly, he keeps going back and forth and everything. He said that he was gonna, you know, sign the deal, and then now even today, he had this statement that was like, "Oh, we can't negotiate with Russia because Russia's gonna come in and they're gonna want us to limit the size of our army. They're gonna want whatever change of the constitution, they're going to want to permanently take parts of Ukraine and make them part of Russia, da, 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 da. So because of all of this, you know, we can't negotiate with them." And it's like, what, do you understand how negotiating works? Like, so they're going to come in with those initial terms and you're going to, you're basically just not willing to negotiate because you won't give up anything, even though you're losing the war. But in any negotiations, you know, you figure out what you can do. There's a few things. See, really, they should have been negotiating this entire damn time, whether or not they came to any point, because it keeps you talking. It gives, you know, there's things you can do. You can do different gestures of good faith in both sides. But, you know, any of those things, it's like a step closer to Russia permanently having, you know, some of those territories or whatever, which they're gonna regardless. So just accept reality. Yeah. You know, a big one has been, and Putin mentioned this talking to Tucker about how he thought they would reconcile, is, you know, there are people in the Donbas who are supposed to have Ukrainian pensions, which is what you call social security there. So not just like government employees, but, you know, and they've not been getting those paid for like 10 years. So, you know, you get Russia to agree to permanently take those over. And then it's one issue that's not a sticking point between the countries because they've came under, you know, Russia's claiming them as their citizens. Mm-hmm. You could start working on a plebiscite in Crimea, which everyone knows. And people talk about how the referendum was bullshit, but everyone knows that they would vote to join Russia. No one seriously denies that.
Yeah.
It would take years to agree on who was a 2014 resident and like deserves to be able to vote. So then you have people talking about the voting list, da, da, da. That takes time, but you're working on something productive and it gives Zelensky the cover for letting Crimea go, which they're never getting back anyway. You know, you'd also potentially get Russia to agree that they're not going to take certain areas, you know, like that they're absolutely under no circumstances taking certain areas like Lviv that, you know, used to be part of Poland, but was never part of Russia. But, you know, if they agree that there are certain areas they're not taking, then it leaves them taking other areas on the table. So it's just Zelensky's still taking his maximalist position. I mean, really, the Ukrainians need to just bonk him on the head and throw him over the front lines with the white flag tied to him, but they're yet to do that for whatever reason. I don't think he did finally re-enter the country. It was a really long time without him re-entering the country after that meeting with Trump. Like, if I was the generals, I wouldn't even let his plane land in Ukraine. I would tell him to get bent and, you know, go stay in Paris or something, and that they're going to hold new elections. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, honestly, that'd be the way to go. Yeah, it's so interesting because I had really thought, and even from like the first 40 minutes of the meeting, it really seemed like Zelensky was basically going to get the status quo. Like Trump had said, hey, we're going to do this mineral deal. He'll get peacekeeping troops, which is more than Biden even did, right? Because once again, this is pretty ambiguous, like as to what peacekeeping troops really means. Like it that really is just kind of like a tripwire to basically get us fighting Russia, as if all this stuff already isn't. But, you know, I mean, that specifically, that's a little much. And then he even said, you know, we'll still send weapons, we'll still send aid. And basically, like I said, it's a status quo, except we're going to get a mineral deal. And the mineral deal is, you know, to extract the minerals from the Russian occupied part of Ukraine. So like, how is this supposed to all work? Like,
no, that's the part that has good minerals you can actually access. Yes. You know, the Ukraine was really heavily developed by the Soviets, like almost everything that's economical to get, they're already mining. And that's all in the east.
Yeah, so it seemed like that he was just going to walk away with basically like he had all the cards. All he had to do, like you said, is basically kiss the ring and just tell Trump how great he is, and then everything would have been fine, right? But though he's such an entitled little prick, Zelensky is such an entitled little asshole that he couldn't just shut up, kiss the ring, and then walk away. But really, I think it mostly was J.D. Vance that was kind of like the tiebreaker here, because J.D. Vance sat and he didn't say a word throughout the whole meeting up until about like, I think it was like 39 minutes, if I remember correctly. But right around there is when he said, hey, we're trying to save your country. And I think it's disrespectful for you to come in here and kind of dictate terms or whatever. And then it was like almost like a switch flipped on Trump, because he came right to J.D. Vance's back and said, no. He even like he touched Zelensky, and like it was very like assertive way that he was kind of starting to physically interact with Zelensky. So it was very, very funny just kind of how that all played out.
Yeah. It was therapeutic, honestly, after all of these years of watching him go around from court to court, like, you know, I don't know, he's Hannibal after he got chased out of Italy, just asking all these people to help him fight his enemy, etc. It's just so dumb. I mean, you know, it shouldn't bother me so damn much that he won't wear a suit. But like, it's ridiculous. Like you're like going there to beg for people to give you all this money, and you're not a warrior king or anything. You're also, there's not even a real military uniform. That's like what a soldier exercises in, you know, like that's what that is. It's absolutely ridiculous. And like, you're in a foreign country. Like, yeah, when you are visiting the front line, wear a military suit. That's what everyone does in that situation, is where, you know, almost everyone does in that situation is wear appropriate clothing for that. That's completely fine. But you're visiting foreign dignitaries in foreign countries. Like, you've just been on the plane for 12 hours. Like, you wearing that ridiculous outfit the whole time. You know, it's like what I keep saying, actually, is that Zelensky has it all figured out, that, you know, they're going to get a frozen conflict. He's never going to end the state of emergency. Then they're never going to have new elections. And so he's going to be like the Kim Jong Il of Ukraine. And he already dresses the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much how it's kind of seeming. So when it comes to kind of how this is going to go forward, obviously it's anybody's guess. I have my speculation, but what do you think is going to happen in the coming weeks with Trump and Ukraine? Because it sounds like he still wants to do this mineral deal. My opinion is just like, just fucking leave it be, dude. Just cut your fucking losses already.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that if Ukraine's determined to fight, I mean, the Ukrainians are done with this, basically. You know, if they'd let them vote, Zelensky would be gone. They'd get a candidate that's willing to work for peace. The parliament's not that far from throwing him out. He lost a... oh, it's a, it was a resolution basically that was like saying it was a resolution about the importance of maintaining consistent leadership during war, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's basically a resolution on whether or not they should have elections, and he lost. So, you know, they could find a way to throw him out at any time, but it's going to be very difficult because there's so much, you know, global interest if Russia has to fight them into, you know, an actual surrender or whatever. But at the same time, Europe is weak as hell. They're full of cowards. You know, 20% of Germans would fight for their country, and half of the people that answered yes are probably from foreign countries and not even talking about Germany when they answered yes to that question. The only one in Western Europe that has an independent military is France. The rest of them are just completely in NATO's unified command structure and, you know, aren't set up to do anything without the United States. The UK's military, people keep saying this, I guess I should verify it. People keep saying it has more admirals than it has ships, like than it has actual like large ships, which is crazy because it was obviously like an admiral is supposed to be in charge of like many ships, you know. So none of them can do anything. You know, Article 5 doesn't even apply when you're in another country. And it seems like Poland and most of them are taking our side. So, well, I mean, we'll see what they end up doing. But, you know, if they have peacekeeping troops, they're going to be on the other side of the Dnieper. So, and realistically, that's the most reasonable line of control for the lower part of it. It's fairly easy to not accidentally get into border skirmishes or, you know, have any confusing situations when you have a river between you instead of, you know, an arbitrary line somewhere. So that seems, you know, what's most likely to happen. And then, you know, Ukraine's never recovering from this. Like, right. We may or may not successfully take the very dirt that they walk on, but, you know, they're already in demographic collapse. They lost a ton of men. No one's going to want to move home to rebuild it. The men are going to try to join their women abroad. Yeah, they're never recovering from this already. And they just want to keep going. I mean, that's maybe why they've just given up and they're just suicidal. I'm not sure. It's really just Zelensky, though, which, once again, I think he might not understand how negotiating works in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally possible. as Trump and Vance both said, you don't have the cards. With us, you have the cards. You have a damn good chance.
But he said, I'm not having the cards. Yeah. It's like, you obviously know that expression. Stop it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, it was kind of funny to listen to like his borderline broken English, and somebody that
he seriously sounds like a troll in a fairy tale, or like a goblin, Rumpelstiltskin would sound like, or something.
Yeah, yeah. He actually does. Somebody that follows me on Twitter had said that they actually confirmed that Zelensky did say "bitch" to JD Vance in Ukrainian, yeah. Which I or
probably in Russian, actually, which is his native language. I doubt he accidentally swears in Ukrainian.
Yeah, is Ukrainian actually a language, or do they speak something else?
It is. They claim that it's not mutually intelligible, though. Often, when that's the case, it's just that people are being dicks and no one can understand it. You know, it's like. I don't know if you hate people from the South or Kentucky or something like that. And you're like, oh, I can't understand what you're saying. I need to speak more clearly. So I don't know. They claim that they can't understand each other, but to an outsider, they sound exactly the same. Regardless, Russian is Zelensky's native language, and he refuses to speak it now. He had to get a tutor to help him speak Ukrainian when he got into politics.
Oh, wow. Jeez, how funny is that? Yeah, it just this whole situation was so funny because I think I might have thrown a status up on Facebook about this where I said it kind of turned out to be like the non-interventionist dream where all because of Zelensky's own hubris and the fact that he's such a little asshole that he's going to like put the U.S. in like our opinions, like the best situation it could possibly be in, which is basically no mineral deal, Ukraine doesn't get any more weapons, and now we are completely separated from it. Which just like I'm all about it because I was saying pretty much throughout the Trump campaign, I'm like, I don't think this is going to end because first of all, Trump doesn't have a plan. He doesn't sound like he has any idea on how to negotiate with this whole situation. And then he's calling for arming more and everything. But though, you know, now it just literally seems like Zelensky pissed him off enough to basically just give us what we wanted.
Yeah, well, allegedly, Trump also just told our, you know, supposed allies to stop sharing intelligence with them as well. Mm-hmm. Which I mean, I don't know. The Ukrainians are dangerous. Like, they're a bunch of them are Nazis. They clearly hate anyone. You know, they're clearly so entitled that they're like violently attack people that they don't give them what they feel they deserve. et cetera. So, I mean, I think it's a good move, but, you know, nothing we get under the table. I mean, the other thing is, though, a lot of people, you know, also are don't understand how negotiating works, because, like, obviously, if Trump is trying to get Ukraine the best deal that he can so that it looks like he settled this in a good way for them, you know, so it obviously does involve saying, like, oh, we're gonna keep arming them, we're gonna look at what sort of security guarantee we can give them, et cetera. You know, you kind of do need all of those things on the table to negotiate. But he's apparently just gonna run it into the ground. So I mean, if I was Russia, I would be prepping for a huge offensive right now, because they're running out of. So the other crazy thing is that they keep saying, like, oh, if we stop fighting, Russia's just gonna use that time to rearm. And it's like, okay, Russia doesn't need time to rearm. You need time to rearm. Like, the disparity in what in your necessities here is completely different. So, like, Russia has massively increased their production, increased their army size, increased everything else, and they're really not being hurt by Ukraine. It's a total lie that this has bled Russia out. It's only made them stronger. You know, even if they've lost men and material that can be replaced, it's Ukraine that needs time so badly to rearm. It's like, there's no way that in 10 years, in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, that the power disparity between Ukraine and Russia will be as great as it is right now, assuming that Ukraine would be focused on, you know, rebuilding a strong army in that amount of time.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to, like, Russia's strategy whenever it comes to war is basically, like, they're such a large country and they just have enough people there that are willing to fight, and they could just endlessly throw people at the problem until the problem's fixed. And I was talking about this on my other show, 5 Till Midnight, on Monday, where it's kind of like, I think the people who, you know, thought you or there's kind of like two sides, right? Where one side thought that Russia was just going to walk right into Kiev. You know, the old line was Putin told whoever it was that, oh, you know, I could be in Kiev in 2 weeks. Well, the people who thought that was going to be reality, I think they severely underestimated how much the West was willing to collectively throw their weight behind Ukraine. And then obviously the pro-Ukrainian people obviously way overestimated how Ukraine was going to do.
Well, what actually happened was that they stopped their advance because they were negotiating a peace that Ukraine was going to sign until they were talked out of signing it. So then by then they had reinforced everything, et cetera. But they were, like, turning around as a sign of good faith because they were expecting Ukraine to sign the deal, and then they didn't sign it. And now hundreds of thousands of people are dead, you know, between the both sides. It's absolutely ghoulish. I don't even know what they're going to say about this. But, you know, what's really funny, though, is the people that are mad about what happened with Trump and Zelensky, like, the reason they're mad is because they think it's going to stop us from getting into more retard situations like the Ukraine war in the future. Like, that's to them is why it is such a bad thing. It's really something else.
Yeah, I mean, with the current Trump administration, you really can't rule out, especially with Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz, them doing anything that is just absolutely retarded when it comes to foreign policy. So, you know, I know, like you said, people are mad because they think it's going to get us out of situations like that, or, you know, leave out the potential of us getting into more situations like that. But, you know, obviously, under the last Trump administration with Marco Rubio, they were very, very hawkish on South America, you know, specifically.
Yeah, well, we're going to feel like, oh, next time people, you know, won't trust us for protection or whatever. And it's like, good, I told the Ukrainians not to. They wouldn't listen to me. I told them over and over and over again that in the end, this isn't going to work. They're going to get sold out, and that Zelensky's going to be the fall guy for the entire thing. And that's still absolutely what's going to happen. So I could only possibly think that people getting that message is a good thing, because it's what I have been trying to convince people of, and no one listens.
Yeah, and anybody that thought Ukraine had any kind of chance, my buddy Red Hawk had brought this up to me once, but I'm sure you've seen, like, the former military intelligence guys, who, you know, all thought Ukraine was going to do super well. Like, there's this one dude I listen to, his name's Mark Sartain, and, like, I don't have any personal problems with this guy, but, like, I remember him saying, oh, Russia's, or, you know, Ukraine's going to win this war. I'm like, you were, like, former military intelligence. How could you possibly think a country that's 1/16th the size of the United States was going to beat Russia? You know, the world's, what, third largest superpower? How did you think that was going to work?
In fairness, they think that Finland won the Winter War, and it definitely didn't. So, I mean, like, it lost more territory than Stalin demanded in the first place. Like, they killed a lot more Soviets than died of Finland, absolutely. But by every conceivable definition, the USSR won the Winter War against Finland. And, you know, they certainly did. I mean, I don't know. There was definitely a point early in this where showing their willingness to resist could get them the best deal possible compared to rolling over or, you know, compared to fighting till the end. But that time passed in like April of 2022, you know, and they just keep weakening their position the longer that this goes on. And in the end, you know, as of that summer, I was saying that Ukraine had already lost and should conditionally surrender in return for keeping Odessa and the associated coastline. And, you know, it still looks like that might be how this ends, which would just mean simply that by fighting for another 2.5 freaking years, they, you know, they ended up managing to hold on to the part that I, you know, I was saying they should have just, you know, agreed to surrender in order for, you know, holding on to or whatever. So, you know, it's crazy, but, you know, there's this thing that Matt Taibbi said, this would be in like 2022 now, that I think about all the time, which is that he said in the 2000s, we went from there, you know, saying we don't negotiate with terrorists, which is like an intellectually defensible position, whether or not it's right, whether or not they actually did that, you know, et cetera. You can make a fair argument that that's a good policy, because, you know, I don't know, whatever. But they went to, you know, we don't negotiate with anyone. We don't speak to anyone.
Yeah.
And that's always like, oh, do you really think you can negotiate with Putin? Yeah, man. It's a how do you think the world works? Like,
yeah. Well, what other choice do you have?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, is the people that want this to keep going on have no viable solution at all for Ukraine to come to any, you know, sort of different conclusion or any sort of victory, which is, you know, what J.D. Vance said very clearly. But it's crazy because you know, their main reason for not doing this is that they say like, oh, well, Russia violated the Budapest Memorandum. It's like, okay, well, that was not that strong of a treaty. It was like a general understanding. Secondly, Ukraine never had access to those nukes in the first place. And if they did, if they still had them, they would have sold them to terrorists or something, because it's Ukraine. That's how Ukraine functions. And Ukraine sold missile technology to Iran, which they claim they blame Russia for, because they don't believe in accountability. But regardless, after that memorandum was in place, they sold missile technology to Iran, which, I mean, also people claim, oh, that doesn't technically violate it, because it was only for nuclear-related technology. And though those warheads were made for carrying nukes, the technology itself was conventional. And it's like, oh, whatever, asshole. They sold missiles to Iran, which was exactly the point of this memorandum, was to stop them from selling missiles to Iran and other countries like that. And everyone else had violated that memorandum too. But the bigger thing is like, okay, say what you will about that, the Budapest Memorandum held for 20 plus years. So, you know, you think it's not worth making a peace treaty if it only lasts 20 years? And so you have like a new generation of people fighting the war. You have Putin dead by the time it goes, like, what are you talking about? That's crazy. You're not, you know, treaties last until they don't. That's like the nature of a treaty. You know, it lasting 20 plus years for not even being a formal treaty, it was more like a general understanding, is not a sign to not do anything with Russia. And that wasn't Putin's treaty in the first place. He was still like an intelligence officer when that was signed. He wasn't even like a government insider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've always found this position of the fucking shit libs so bizarre, that like, oh my God, he's cozying up to Putin. It's like, well, what else are you supposed to do? Like, are we just supposed to not communicate with other world superpowers? Even Marco Rubio acknowledged it at this point. And I have a friend who said that who said, oh, it's dumb to say it's a multipolar world now. But like, it truthfully is, like, China is now rising very, very, you know, in a very big economic way. Obviously Russia, I think, is pretty far behind that, but, you know, they're still a distinct superpower themselves.
It so very like, obviously has a sphere of influence, hence this war going on.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So like, these countries are going to have a sphere of influence, and, you know, the people who are always talking about like the Monroe Doctrine, right? Because we treat South America like dog shit and China doesn't. We have to cooperate with these countries. Like, we don't have a choice. We don't dominate the world anymore. And, you know, it really does seem like where we're not willing to do diplomacy, other countries will. So, like, you know, all in South Africa and everything, you know this just as well as I do, that China's doing diplomacy all over Africa, and it benefits them largely. It benefits both parties, really. You know, whereas the U.S., you know, what kind of diplomacy are we engaged in anymore? You know, we just, for Venezuela, we just stole some of Nicolas Maduro's fucking helicopters after
his,
you know,
planes. Yeah, that was great. Yeah. That was a crazy thing to do. Right. Yeah. Anyway, you know, it's ridiculous. I think they just partially don't understand about the premise of negotiating. And they also, you know, the NAFO idiots claim that their outlook is what they call neo-idealism, which just means that I can say the world should be however I want it to be. And then, you know, we don't have to pay any attention to what actually works or what is possible, et cetera. It's completely absurd. And, you know, the things that they're so dumb, like, oh, the message from this is going to be that strong countries can do whatever they want. It's like, yeah, man, like that's always been the case. What the hell are you talking about? Or like, oh, if we do this, Putin will have gone away with it. It's like, yeah, dude, when you win wars, you get away with things. Like that's the nature of it. Robert McNamara said on camera that when they were planning the firebombing of Japan, they knew that if the U.S. lost the war, they would be tried and found guilty as war criminals. Like he said that on camera in a documentary. That they knew that at the time as they were planning the firebombing of Japan. Like, this is simply how the world has always worked. And it's just, I guess they just bought into the, people really bought into the premise that the world changed after World War II, like the nature of international relations changed permanently. When in reality, it's just the treaty put into place by the winners of the last major conflict. Like, whether or not the UN falls apart, if there's like a World War III, or when there's a World War III or whatever, you know, it will be massively reformed by how that goes, because in a strange way, the United States and Russia are allies and were the entire Cold War, because they're still the ones that are chiefly responsible for maintaining the global power of war and peace and, you know, the Security Council and everything else. Like all the countries on the Security Council are actually allies when you think about it, insofar as they're maintaining this specific world order against everyone else, you know, this agreement that they have. But you know, this has happened multiple times in history. You have like the Metternich's Vienna Congress, or you know, any number of things like that. But they just believed that the world was changed permanently, and that we've moved past things being that way. It was always bullshit. But I, you know, I guess we were raised to believe that, and plenty of them actually did. I never did, but.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just a completely different world now, and we can't assume that, you know, where they said the unipolar moment, it's basically done. Like, we don't.
And the U.S. squandered that anyway. Like, what good was it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we spent all that capital fighting wars all over the world, and it just generally made the world a worse place. Whereas, you know, China and Russia are kind of seeking to not necessarily do that. And, you know, people could have their issues with that. But, you know, it's they're definitely operating in the world a more, you know, better diplomatic way that's less hostile to their neighbors and their other countries. And once again, not to say that these countries are benevolent or perfect, but, you know, honestly, these countries, even for their own citizens, have treated them a lot better than the U.S. has treated their own people.
I mean, in many ways, and it's notable that, you know, Ukraine claims that Russia is the source of all of their problems, but things are way better in Russia than in Ukraine. Their, you know, GDP per capita is 2.5 times higher before this started. Ukraine basically never got out of the 90s when they were shock doctrine. And, you know, they just blame all of this on, oh, it's the closeness to Russia that causes this. It's why they want to be in the EU so badly, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, okay, but Belarus is like an actual satrap of Russia and barely reformed after the Soviet Union fell. And it has a higher GDP per capita than Ukraine does. So I think y'all just fucked up independence really badly.
Yeah. And that's kind of the way that it seems to go with these kind of like shell nations, if you will, and like these proxies for the US, is that like, they're not doing that good, but they just so happen to be, you know, ripe for the picking, if you will.
Yeah.
And we were able to kind of fund them to the teeth to, you know, basically combat our enemies.
Yeah, well, the EU poured a ton of money into Poland to try to prove a point about being in the EU being good, basically. So then, you know, Poland's like seen as this big success story. You know, it's in some ways like there's trajectories that allegedly, you know, it could reach basically the level of prosperity of Germany or whatever. But I mean, it's also because Germany's shitty these days. You know, and all this other stuff, but like it didn't really have this impact on, you know, Bulgaria, the other areas in more of the southeast of the European Union that they didn't try to do that with in the same ways. Mm. I don't know. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me wanting to be in the EU badly enough to die for it. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I think when you look at the EU and their whole situation right now, I have a friend who lives in the Netherlands, and he's like, man, I got to get out of here because like in the more right-leaning people obviously have a point about immigration, but I feel like it just, it drives me nuts when people don't ever go back to the foreign policy aspect of this. Like, we literally have just completely turned most of the Middle East into an absolute unlivable hellhole over the last 20 years. And we're like surprised that people wanted to leave because of that. Like, well, obviously when you bomb the shit out of these countries, of course people are going to leave.
You know, that has more to do with the migration 10 years prior to now than the migration now. You know, that doesn't explain why there's 3 million Turks in Germany. I mean, all that explains that is that Germany let them in. The current wave of migration is primarily just the really high birth rates in sub-Saharan Africa. Like, the rate of salary of wage earning in Africa is actually going down, and it's already like 17% or something insanely low like that of people that have any sort of job that pays wages at all. And of course that hinders development, because it's really difficult to tax people that are, like, you know, you can only do like a sales tax or that sort of, like, a small property tax or head tax or whatever on people that are subsistence farmers. Like, you know, if you don't have wages, you don't know what their income is, you can't have payroll taxes, you know, any number of things like that. And it's only going down. You know, there are people that you read about in Senegal that are trying to get to Europe. They're like, yeah, like, I have a college degree and I've been unemployed for the 12 years since I finished college. And, you know, they don't mean laying about. When an African is unemployed, he's generally like subsistence farming or doing whatever, street vending and shit like that, you know. But regardless, the current thing, I mean, you can explain the ways that economic development has been hindered, or they've been destabilized by overthrowing Gaddafi or any number of things like that. But it is primarily just birth rates. You know, women in Chad or in Niger are still having like 6 kids per woman when they already don't have jobs. So, you know, it's just a huge amount of population growth, more so than the foreign policy. But, and, you know, also, if we weren't wasting all of our money on these idiotic military adventures, we could, you know, invest more into Africa, invest more on guarding the borders and not letting people in. You know, it kind of takes a holistic approach. But immigration is only one reason that the EU is going to shit. The EU is shit because it's, you know, designed to be led by an HR department, pantsuit mafia sort of thing. It's, you know, doesn't have, you know, it's supposed to really limit the impact that democratic politics have. It's designed to add another layer of regulation over already regulated European states. The free trade aspect of it is good, but, like, you could just make a free trade union that didn't do all of this other bullshit and you would be fine. And, you know, that is the main thing people want. And you look at this, like, for example, in Georgia, people, you know, a lot of people really want it in the EU. It's been the policy still of this current government that they want in the EU. But, you know, you have a small amount of people that are really ideological about this because they have a master's degree in retardology from Columbia University or something like that. So they're like obsessed with Brussels or whatever, and the European perspective and these things. You know, that's not how normal people think. Normal people think about their material conditions. And so a normal person that wants to in Georgia, that wants to be in the EU, they want to be able to go somewhere and get a job. They want to be able to go somewhere for education. They want to be able to, you know, send money back home or travel back and forth easily, you know, so they have a product that they want to sell in Europe without dealing with regulations. But the thing about that is that Georgia's key advantage to being in the EU involves being able to trade with Russia, because you need to be able to send, you know, like, it involves them being able to get Russian products and sell it there, you know, being like a pass-through point for business with Russia. If they're in the EU, if they're like an outpost of the EU, and there's this whole sanctions regime against Russia, they're not supposed to trade or travel or whatever, they're just profoundly isolated in a way that is terrible for their economic growth, and that gives them no key advantage to actually being in the EU. And people don't see that, because the people that write articles about this, that lead the activist groups, etc., are just completely, you know, in the end of history ideology of, you know, everything needs this supernational, really boring organization that, you know, where we all get together and talk about stupid shit all day and nothing ever happens, you know. It's no way to live, by the way.
To an earlier point, maybe the whole Belt and Road Initiative will actually do a lot to keep people within their own countries, because, and obviously, like, NGOs being disbarred, disbanded, And, you know, having closed borders is another big thing because, you know, obviously the NGOs are bussing in all these immigrants from all over the place. But, you know, if you make their homes a little bit more desirable, which once again, I wouldn't favor the U.S. doing this. But, you know, if China wants to spend all their money, you know, trying to build infrastructure in Africa and stuff like that, and then these people all of a sudden now have more economic growth, and it's kind of fucked up. But, you know,
China gets paid for that. That's not foreign aid.
Right. But I mean, they still... They generally charge it a very, very like low interest loan. Sometimes
long-term loans. I mean, the other thing is that Africans buy a lot of Chinese products, like the people. So this is the best example of this is you always hear about this gold boom across the Sahel. That's entirely driven by access to cheap Chinese metal detectors. That gold was always there. Most of it's surface level. They're not big mines. It's like seriously dudes walking around with metal detectors in just areas where it's heavy and digging all over the place. Yeah. A lot of people that live in, you know, like basically Neolithic settlements have little Chinese solar panels. If you go to Google Street View in Dakar, Senegal, which is one of the few African cities that has it, you find this the China store is what it's called. That is basically it's like a mix between a Walmart and a Costco. In terms of what's there and what it is basically, but it's funny, like you can walk in it because there's a bunch of pictures and see the stuff that they're selling. And so, China benefits a lot from African economic growth because they sell products that Africans can afford to buy, which is less mm-hmm. true of the US. They do see big benefits here to into these markets. They've just massively increased as a trade partner. But regardless, their infrastructure projects are primarily all for money, even if it's like slow and, you know, long-term payments and all this other stuff. They really, of the three major powers, I would say have the least nefarious presence on the African continent in terms of just being there to do productive business. Because like Russia, a lot of people that, you know, would write about Africa work for the think tank class, the Atlantic Institute, or, you know, any number of things like that. And they just say the dumbest shit. This woman spent like a year writing a Washington Post article about how the coups are caused by misinformation, but the coups in Africa are caused by Russian disinformation. And it's like, no, lady, like the cities are full of refugees because there are huge terrorist attacks in the countryside all the time. They're like teeming with people that have fled terrorism, and it undermines the state because it's not providing security. That is not caused by Russian disinformation. That is the people's perceived, or like the real reality people live in every day. But the problem with Russia on the continent that almost any long-term observer causes them to have a pretty negative view is just that Russia's arms industry is really profitable. And so they'll sell arms to anyone that wants them with absolutely no concern for what happens with those weapons. And so they make a bunch of money doing that. And it really just floods the continent with weapons that people are always using in conflicts. And so that anyone that observes African security ultimately develops a very negative view about that because they're just, the continent is just a wash in Russian arms.
The other thing I was kind of thinking about is that as they develop, it's a phenomena that's interesting, but you know, as people get more and more like advanced technologies and get to, you know, basically have more and more commodities, eventually they start to have less and less kids. So, you know, as like the whole nation of Africa changes, you know, granted, we don't know how much that's going to be.
No, African birth rates are going down. I think birth rates in Kenya have gone down 3 kids per woman in the last 30 years or something. I mean, from like 7 to 4, but still, it's a big drop. Birth rates on the continent are still going down, though it's at a trajectory where they'll still have population growth for a long time. You know, have not fallen nearly as far as other places. There are some cultural things here though, because, in Africa in general, having a large family is seen as a sign of wealth, whether or not you could take care of them. It's weird. And you know, there's a thousand different cultures in Africa, but that's pretty universally true that, it's seen as a sign of wealth to have a large family. A big one is they've not got used to the fact that they have much lower infant mortality. Now they still have like a bunch of kids, you know, instead of investing in a few of them. But yeah, the wealthier people still have fewer. I mean, and this, we know a lot of this in ancient Rome because Augustus was always going on about it. Their wealthy people stopped having kids as well. So, you know, people have been talking about this for literally millennia, but birth rates in Africa are pretty consistently declining on a continent-wide level, but not that drastically. Like the continent's probably going to hit, I don't remember what the statistic is, probably going to hit, you know, 2.5 billion people or more before it starts actually having any sort of coming anywhere close to having a population decline.
Yeah, I that kind of raises the point where I've heard people repeat that the world's going to hit the population of about 9 billion and start rapidly declining. And like the more and more I learn about demographics, it sounds true, but I feel like there's a lot more of a nuanced picture from here to there. I just think that like we're going to see such rapid development that, you know, much to an earlier point, that basically like people are going to want to have less and less kids because kids, they realize kids are an expense and they don't want to make that expense anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. It's a complicated issue. I write about demographics a fair amount. But yeah, that's the expectation. A big thing is that, you know, it takes basically a lifetime. There's basically a human lifespan of a lag in, you know, fertility and the population levels. It's like, amazingly, South Korea has more like 80-year-olds alive than it has 1-year-olds alive right now or something like that. Which is fucking nuts, especially because there was the Korean War when the people that are 80 now were little kids. So they must have had a really high rate, you know, a relatively high rate of mortality from the conflict and starvation, you know, et cetera. Yeah, if you look at their pyramid, it's absolutely out of control. And there's like no way you can run a society like that. So I don't know if they'll bring in a bunch of Filipinos or they'll find really, really mechanized ways to do things. But you know, I don't know. There's any number of ways you can try to deal with it, but I think a lot of nations aren't going to, or they're just going to keep, you know, using letting Africans into their country because they feel that they need the population. No one's really dealing with it in a smart way. But, you know, Africa has been really underpopulated for a long time because of the slave trade, because of disease and war, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no reason that Africa, which is enormous, you know, couldn't hold 2 billion people perfectly fine. It hasn't had the economic development, which is a complex issue. But regardless, it is overpopulated for the amount of economic development and jobs and stuff that there is. But, you know, the farmland's underutilized, the minerals are underutilized, there are not a lot of factories. It's certainly everything. And nowhere has ever had such good conditions for an industrial revolution. We'll just see if it happens.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that that kind of encapsulates that pretty damn well. Is that we don't really know. We'll just kind of have to see how all this stuff kind of plays out. So, Brad, I think that's about all I wanted to cover with you today, everything and more. So, as always, give your plugs and we'll close her out.
Okay, well, my main place is my Substack, which is thewaywardrabbler.com. And then I'm also at waywardrabbler on Twitter. I'm a regular contributor at the Libertarian Institute, though I mean somewhat less now, but I still have a good page of articles there. And then I've been writing for the American Conservative, and I'm also now with Commonplace Magazine. I should have my first article coming out there next week. So those are the main places you can find me. I have my own podcast on my Substack called Dispatches from Clown World. It is always free for the first 2 days, and then it goes behind a paywall. So if you sign up, just make sure you get the emails and download it when it comes out.
Beautiful. Yeah, make sure you go check all that stuff out. Brad's writing is very, very thorough. He misses no details, and I do enjoy your writing quite a bit. So everybody, make sure you go check that stuff out. And just I wanted to make sure I throw this out there because I didn't realize listener Eddie knows about this. Next weekend, we're going to be in Evansburg playing with Hate Grenade, and then Lacey Sturm on Friday the 21st, formerly of Flyleaf. I think she's still part of Flyleaf. They're doing tours now, whatever. Yeah, we're playing with them next weekend. And then tomorrow night, if you're in the Youngstown, Ohio area, please, please, please come check us out. I forget the band that's headlining the thing, but it's at the West Side Bowl in Youngstown, Ohio, about an hour and a half away from where I live here in Pittsburgh. And if you're in Ohio, you should definitely come out and check that out. But yeah, I think that's everything I got. So one more time, Brad, thank you so much. And we'll call her a stream there.
All right, thank you. Bye.
At Tanger Outlets, find all the best brands all on sale every day. Step into the season's newest arrivals and save big on the styles you love. Shop Under Armour, Michael Kors, Crocs, and more. With up to 70% off plus an extra 25% off for a limited time. Hurry in for amazing deals from the brands you love. Only at Tanger Outlets.